talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating the Battle of Trafalgar, 220 years on, as we explore a story of strategy, sacrifice and victory on the high seas and its legacy today. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. On the 21st of October 1805, the Battle of Trafalgar took place. It was the battle that shattered Napoleon's naval power, made Horatio Nelson a national legend, and shaped British and Irish history for decades. In tonight's show, we want to find out what really happened on that afternoon, how it was remembered in art, and what was the legacy of the Battle of Trafalgar. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Andrew Lambert is Lawton Professor of Naval History at King's College London, an expert on the naval and strategic history of the British Empire. He's the author of Nelson, Britannia's God of War, Sea Power State, and most recently, No More Napoleons, How Britain Managed Europe from Waterloo to World War I. Dr. Kieran MacDonald is an independent researcher specialising in 18th century war and society. He has published on Irish soldiers in the armies of France and Britain, as well as the Irish militia, and is currently researching the coastal defences of Ireland during the Napoleonic Wars. Well, you're both very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Dr. Catherine Gazzard, the distinguished cultural historian and curator of art at the Royal Museums Greenwich, and the author of J.M.W. Turner's The Battle of Trafalgar, Commemoration and Controversy. Well, as I say, you're both very welcome. And Andrew, I might begin with you. And I might begin with a question, I suppose, about the significance of Trafalgar, because it is such a monumental position in British history, in the British psyche, in British memory. It probably is less significant or has had less of a discussion point in Ireland. So remind us, how important was Trafalgar?
Trafalgar is the definitive British victory. The great hero of the British state, Horatio Nelson, leads the fleet to an absolutely smashing victory over the forces of France and Spain, directed by Napoleon Bonaparte. And this victory means that the French will never be able to invade England, Britain, and it's almost certainly the case that they will not be able to win this war. How Britain and later its allies are able to win the war is another question, but by 1805... is Napoleon going to be the master of the universe, or are the British going to stop him and rebuild a balanced European state system with a much wider range of independent countries? The British are preeminently a maritime naval power rather than a military power. The British will never defeat Napoleon on land on their own. That simply isn't possible. But by defeating and destroying his fleet, they confine Napoleon to Europe. They stop him reaching out to the wider world. He'd already tried to invade Egypt. It stops him becoming a global power, and the British are able to continue trading around the world, securing the home islands, delivering supplies, and using the resources that they're assembling to support their allies. In 1805, the Allied coalition collapses, but by 1814, there's an Allied coalition that has defeated Napoleon. So it's Britain as a great power in a great power system that's balancing out Napoleon. And this battle is so important because it is a British victory on the British element. And it's rendered in many ways, it's slightly blasphemous to say so, but it's rendered as a holy relic by the death of the national hero. And as you stand in Trafalgar Square at the very center of London and look up to this monumental structure which commemorates the battle and the hero, you realize just how important he is in the memory of the British state.
And the story of Nelson, the story of Trafalgar, his band of brothers, that served as an inspiration to later generations. It inspired Winston Churchill during the Second World War. It inspired so many different images and ideas of Britain and its identity and its ability to withstand foreign invasion.
Yes, it's the rallying cry. In 1940, when the French have collapsed, Britain has retreated from the continent, stands alone against Nazi Germany. It is the memory of Trafalgar, it's the memory of Nelson, and Churchill, as a historian and also a man obsessed with glory, uses Nelson, and he intervenes in the making of the great film of the Second World War, that Hamilton Woman, in which Laurence Olivier plays Nelson and Vivian Leigh plays Lady Hamilton. It's an uplifting story about how Britain wins at sea and ultimately triumphs over the enemy evil. And, of course, it is an ideal thing to be saying in 1940. These are very dark days, and there is this model of how the world will turn on its axis, how British sea power will deliver victory with a grand coalition. And by 1945, that story has been repeated. There is no great Nelson figure in the Second World War, but his inspiration is everywhere. British admirals go into battle with a Nelsonic approach. They seek out the enemy, they attack, they destroy, they command the sea. And Nelson is the model both for fighting, but also for propaganda, for getting that message across. The film is very successful in the United States. It's a very good way of spreading that argument around the world. Nelson and Trafalgar have become a universal product that almost every country in the world that has a coast or any sense of the sea is well aware of Trafalgar. And quite a lot of them have people involved.
You wrote a brilliant piece about Nelson for History Today, and you described how he had the courage to act when others waited for orders and the genius to be right on almost all occasions. And you explored how he became this big inspiration, how he was constantly reinvented. And it shows how, despite the mythology, he really was an exceptional military commander and leader.
Yes, Nelson's genius, I think the easiest way to explain it is when he commands the fleet, he makes everybody else's job easy. He does the hard things. He works out how to defeat the enemy. He clears away any possibility of the enemy winning. Trafalgar, the defining moment is early in the morning of the battle. He realizes there's going to be a big storm later that day. So he has to finish the battle quickly before the storm breaks and basically disperses the fleets. He changes his tactics from clever, sophisticated tactics, which he'd planned to use, to a direct head-on attack, because that's the only way to get the battle to a conclusion before the storm ends. Normally, in fleet battles, the admiral is in the middle of the fleet, where he can see the most, and is at the center of the fleet. Nelson abandons that. He takes the lead. He puts the victory at the front of the fleet, and his second-in-command, Collingwood, takes the lead of the second column in his flagship. So his job is now to take down the enemy's command and control system. The enemy flagship shows its flag. Nelson puts the victory right under the stern of the French flagship, the Bucentaure, and with his first broadside, he effectively destroys the cohesion of the Franco-Spanish fleet, because after that broadside, the Bucentaure is crippled. It can't signal. It can't move. The individual French and Spanish ships are now leaderless. They don't have anybody giving them direction. They're just stuck in a fighting situation against more professional, better manned, better led individual British ships. And as Nelson knows, it takes between 20 and 50 minutes for a British ship to take a French or Spanish ship in single combat. So he's done all the hard yards. He's destroyed the enemy's cohesion, their line of battle. He's broken up the enemy into individual ships, and he knows that his people will win those combats. So the final score at the end of the battle is 19-0.
That is an incredible score. But Andrew, how much was he helped by the French Navy being weakened by the French Revolution, the suspicion of the naval commanders it had? Anyone with an aristocratic connection was executed or imprisoned or fled. And it just seems that the French Navy was nowhere near as strong as its army, and they were undermining their own naval power.
The French don't help themselves, but right through the 18th century, Britain and France are the great rival naval powers fighting for empire in the New World and in India and beyond. France is not a maritime country. It's a continental country with two coasts. They have a big coast on the Atlantic and on the English Channel, but they're also very much a Mediterranean power. So their navy isn't unified. It's two separate navies facing in different directions. And the sailors of the fleet in Napoleon's day didn't speak French. They spoke Breton or Provençal, which were different languages. So it's not a national enterprise. The demolition of the officer corps had largely been rectified by the Battle of the Nile in 1798, when Nelson literally annihilated the entire French Mediterranean fleet. What he did at that battle not only destroyed the physical side of the fleet, but it removed those rising new Republican captains who were trying to take the Navy forward. And after Napoleon becomes an emperor, he's not really interested in Republicans. He's now the emperor. And so the Republican tinge in the Navy is expunged. The French are never able to get enough high-quality sailors together to man their ships effectively. They build good ships, but they don't have well-trained men. And they can't get to sea because Nelson doesn't allow them to come out. And if you don't go to sea and practice, whether you're sailing a yacht or sailing a 74-gun battleship, you are not going to be very good on the first day out. And that's what happens with the fleet at Trafalgar. Most of the Spanish ships haven't been anywhere for a long time. So we've got amateurs, undertrained crew. We've got a limited number of officers. But the French had lost all of the naval wars of the 18th century. The old regime lost the wars at sea, and the new regime lost the wars at sea. Britain valued sea control as an existential requirement. If you lose sea control from the British perspective, you will be invaded by the French with a very large army. So the navy is the top priority. It's much more important than the army, whereas for the French, it's the other way around. So as Napoleon said, it's the elephant fighting the whale. And when it comes to sea fighting, the whale is always going to win.
Yeah, Ciarán, the whale is always going to win. It's interesting hearing about Horatio Nelson. Of course, in Ireland and in Dublin, there was a monument, a pillar to Nelson that was erected in 1809, blown up in 1966 in advance of the 1916 50-year anniversary. And it shows how, you know, maybe the image of Nelson here is probably more associated with that pillar.
Yes, absolutely, Patrick. The Royal Navy doesn't really feature too much in the historiography of Ireland, despite the fact that about a third to a quarter of the Navy at any one time was Irish. Officially, Catholics were not supposed to be recruited to either the Navy or to the Army, but quite often, like Nelson himself, a blind eye was turned to Catholic recruitment because naval recruiters simply needed men. And Dublin and Cork and Belfast and Wexford provided a lot of recruits. All these port towns provided a lot of recruits, both volunteers and then at certain times impressed men as well. But it was still very important to recruit.
Explain the impressed men and the press ganging that went on, because I think that will surprise a lot of people.
Yes, so this was when naval officers were authorised to go in to towns, port towns specifically, and try and eye up experienced seamen if they could find them, and if they couldn't, just anyone that they could round up that were in the streets and press them for naval service. So it was effectively they were abducting them off the streets and forcing them to join and serve in the Royal Navy. Now they would be paid, they would become naval recruits, but it was a system that was very unpopular, and a lot of communities, if they heard wind that maybe the press gang was coming, that they would either try and fend them off physically, form together mobs to fight them off, or the men would all disappear. And particularly the skilled men. So that was the real target, was to get skilled civilian seamen, merchant seamen, who would be able to quickly learn the ropes for life at sea.
And Ciarán, how much do we know, or do we know anything about the loyalty of the Irish who served in the Royal Navy? Because I'm sure there was a whole range and mix of feelings, but given that you have the era of the 1798 rebellion and the United Irishmen and a rise in nationalism, do we know anything about their loyalties?
Certainly, there were a lot of former 1798 prisoners who were sent to the Navy. Usually, if you were captured, you were given a choice. You could be sent to the Army, to the Navy, or transported to Australia. And obviously, a lot of them would have chosen the military life rather than transportation. And a certain number of them would have ended up in the Royal Navy. And as a result, at the naval mutinies at the Nore and Spithead, specifically the Nore, a lot of the sailors involved were Irish. Now, it's hard to tell whether their political persuasions prior to their naval service influenced them as much as just life on the sea. I think we see from both the Navy and from the Army that once they were sent to the military, former rebels often just got on with things, and their day-to-day existence became more important than a political persuasion. And as a result, then the tough conditions that was imposed on the Navy, and particularly because both at Spithead and the Nore, these sailors were, it was thought that this had happened because they were idle. They'd been left idle and cooped up in port rather than out and being active. So that might be kind of more of the reason why there was these mutinies, and it was about pay and conditions rather than political persuasions at this point.
And of course, the Irish coastline was also affected and changed by the fear of a French invasion. And you even see it now with the Martello Towers.
Absolutely. Ireland was a very important location for the Royal Navy, both for this over transatlantic sea routes across to America, to the colonies until they were lost, and then, of course, Canada. And also out for trading down through down to Spain and so on. So Ireland was located in a very strategic position. Until the 1790s, there wasn't an independent Irish naval station. Royal Navy ships patrolling Irish waters reported back to England, back to Plymouth. So as a result, it was seen as not quite as important. But it's really when Napoleon starts amassing his invasion army in and around Boulogne and the other camps on the north coast of France, that an invasion scare travels across Britain and Ireland. And as you said, the Martello Towers are the most famous and the most lasting of these. Around 100 or so were built across the coast of England, concentrated mostly on the south coast, as one would expect. And then about 52 are built in Ireland, clustered around Dublin, which of course was seen as very important, and then scattered along the south and the west coasts, kind of up as far as Lough Swilly and Lough Foyle as well. So they were built at a cost of about £250,000 at the time, which is a gigantic sum. You could liken it to maybe the strategic deterrent of something like a nuclear submarine fleet nowadays. They were never needed to be tested, but they were there and just in case. And they were very important. Each one manned at least one cannon, some two. They were built in conjunction with naval gun batteries, which were smaller structures, particularly along the Shannon Estuary, and over 100 signal towers, which people might recognise. There's one up on Dalkey Hill. There's other ones, famous one at Glen Head, up in Glen Columkill in Donegal, and all across from Dublin, stretching all across the coast, going in a clockwise direction all the way up to Malin Head. These signal towers were built within sight of each other. So if a French invasion fleet appeared at any point along these vulnerable coastlines, word could be sent rapidly along that line to the other signal towers, and word could be got to a French, so to the Royal, to a, whichever Royal Navy squadron was nearest to come and help intercept, as well as providing information to the people on the land that in that a force was had been sighted. So they had the tower was built just to defend the men, and then there was a separate mast which had flags and balls on it that would be signaled a bit like a semaphore, but not quite, to warn of an impending French landing, which had happened. It had almost happened in 1796 with 14,000, 15,000 men led by Hoche. And then it had happened in 1798 with the French under General Humbert up at Calada. So the invasion threat was real.
Andrew, returning then to the Battle of Trafalgar and Nelson's leadership during that, he seems to have been incredible at boosting the morale of the people around him, walking around them, sharing ideas, talking to them. He was able to adapt his tactics to whatever the particular occasion was, different tactics for the Battle of the Nile and for Copenhagen and now for Trafalgar. And even that iconic, famous message of England expects that every man will do his duty, you know, which became, you know, an incredible and an integral part of his legends and his legacy. Originally, you show how it was going to be England confides, but luckily he changed it.
Nelson was working with a brand new signalling system, which allowed him to send more verbal style messages, an immediate appeal to his men. The word confide is something that's in his lexicon because he grows up as a son of the church in England. And you find every now and again that the church language of his father comes through in the way that he speaks. His signal officer, John Pascoe, when confronted with the word confide, said it would be much better, my lord, to say expects, because I can send that as one flag, whereas I will have to spell out confides as a series of flags. So it's about immediacy, it's about access. And many of the men on the ships would have been able to read the flags because they would have served as flag ratings. So the message goes out and the whole fleet cheers because what he's saying is not England and not expect. He's saying Nelson trusts that you will all do your duty. It's a personal, encouraging, uplifting message. It's the last thing they're going to hear before they go out and do battle with the enemy. It's a rallying cry. We're familiar with this in sporting matches. The captain gives you an uplifting speech and off you go to play. This is quite serious play. The only man in the fleet who doesn't understand what's going on is Nelson's lifelong friend, Collingwood, who said, what on earth is Nelson sending signals for? We all know what we need to do. Well, Nelson understands that the men will appreciate that uplifting, morale-boosting, I have every confidence that we are going to win this battle. He was pretty sure they would take at least 20 of the enemy ships, and the final score was 19. So his genius is that he's able to adapt new technology, new signaling systems, a very unpleasant change in the weather, to his benefit. He's never caught out by events. He's able to rise to every challenge and surpass them. The only challenge he's not able to get past, obviously, is being mortally wounded. But even that, I think, is a key part of his legend.
And then the fact that he is hit by a musket ball and dies 3 hours later, just as the final guns are going silent, and his last words apparently, thank God I've done my duty, although there's various different accounts of what he might have said. And that then immediately elevates him to the pantheon of great British heroes who in that dying moment had secured Britain's freedom and liberty.
He's very aware of this. When he's growing up as a young man, his hero is James Wolfe, the general who conquered Quebec and secured Canada for the British Empire. And Wolfe died at the very moment that he won the battle that settled the campaign to conquer Canada. So there was something almost perfect in this. There was a great picture of the death of Wolfe painted by Benjamin West, who is the president of the Royal Academy. And Nelson knew West, and he said, you know, it would be worth dying to be remembered like that. And he would be painted dying on board the Victory on several occasions by Benjamin West, who didn't ever quite get it right. But there is a much more famous picture of the lower deck where Nelson is dying, which we often see. So he he's writing himself into the record as an inspiration, as an exemplar, as a leader. And going back to that question you were discussing earlier, his relationship with Ireland is, many of the officers as well as the men in his fleet are from Irish families. And the Dublin Pillar was commissioned by a man called Arthur Wellesley, who we know as the Duke of Wellington, who was also born in Dublin and was chief secretary to the Irish government at the time. So there is a very large Irish story here, but it's not a story that's been part of the history in the way that it is in the United Kingdom. Those many of those men who were impressed were skilled seafarers. The Royal Navy was always short of skilled men, and if they found any who they thought were British, and in those days that did include the whole of the island of Ireland, the king had a legal right to take them into service in wartime for the defense of the country, the equivalent of modern conscription. You're a skilled man, you have these skills, we need them, and for the duration of the conflict, we would like you to come and serve in the Navy, or else. But Nelson's leadership is a way of getting past those resentments. The men go into battle fully enthused. They're not worrying about being impressed. They're thinking about what they're going to do. And his leadership is very much focusing them on the task in hand.
Well, very much focused indeed on that task in hand. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be speaking to Dr. Catherine Gazzard about J.M.W. Turner's iconic The Battle of Trafalgar. And we'll be finding out about how that portrayed the famous battle and indeed some of the controversies that arose afterwards. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are debating the Battle of Trafalgar on this, the 220th anniversary. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Dr. Catherine Gazzard, the distinguished cultural historian and curator of art at the Royal Museums Greenwich, and the author of J.M.W. Turner's The Battle of Trafalgar, Commemoration and Controversy. Catherine, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is, of course, the 250th anniversary of the birth of Turner, and we did a show earlier in the year on him. And, of course, then it's the 220th anniversary of this iconic painting. And it's Turner's largest painting. It's his only royal commission, and it also is one of his most controversial paintings.
That's absolutely correct. So we're celebrating 220 years since the Battle of Trafalgar. But what makes Turner's painting, the one we have here at Greenwich, so exciting is that it's not painted in the immediate aftermath of the battle. It's not his immediate response to the battle. It's actually painted in 1824, so he's reflecting back after two decades on what Trafalgar meant. Because Trafalgar as a battle isn't just important in terms of what it means for the war at sea. It has a huge cultural impact in Britain. There's already a long-standing tradition of celebrating naval success, and Trafalgar has all the ingredients to make it a sort of a legend in the minds of the public. Not only do you have a spectacular victory, you also have, in the death of Lord Nelson, this sort of elevation of a figure who was already a contemporary celebrity into this kind of martyred, heroic figure. And that's something that captures Turner's imagination that he returns to throughout his career, is really reflecting on in his painting, The Battle of Trafalgar.
And it's interesting that he did a huge amount of research for it, and he wanted to investigate some of the details. And then he was someone who admired Nelson an awful lot. He was one of his heroes. But then he wasn't taking an uncritical eye to war, to battle, and he wanted to show it in all of its details and elements.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Turner is someone who was really interested in Trafalgar. When victory came back in 1806, or in early 1806, it's undergoing repairs. He goes and he sketches the battle damage. So he has this kind of memory of the details of the action. But when he comes to paint the Battle of Trafalgar much later, he's trying to reflect back on not just the specifics of what happened. You know, if you want a blow-by-blow account of the Battle of Trafalgar, Turner's painting is not the one you want to look at. What he's trying to reflect on when he's working on this painting is everything that Trafalgar means. And that ranges from the death of Nelson, this singular heroic figure, through to the sacrifice of the ordinary sailors too. So I really think of the painting as being in two halves. In the upper half of the painting, you have the ships of the two fleets. And in the background, it's really chaotic. There's overlapping sails and masts and rigging. It really captures the chaos that Nelson's tactics were designed to introduced, you know, his breaking of the enemy line. But Turner does place the victory, Nelson's flagship, right in the center Nelson. And there are even symbolic details there that allude to Nelson and his fate. For example, victory is flying signal flags from the mainmast, and those signal flags spell out the word duty, which is obviously a reference to the signal that Nelson sent to the fleet at the start of the action. England expects that every man will do his duty. But in picking out that word duty, Turner is also referring to some of Nelson's widely reported final words. He lay dying in victories, sort of below decks in the victory, sort of later in the battle. Nelson is reported to have said, "Thank God I have done my duty." There's that word again. But Nelson is really present in the painting. But at the same time, he was not the only person who lost their life that day. In fact, there's over 4,000 casualties across, you know, to both sides. And the majority of those are the ordinary sailors who are crewing these warships. And Turner foregrounds their sacrifice too. So the lower half of the painting, the other half of the painting, is it shows you the waves and all these small boats and these sailors who've been thrown from their ships and they're struggling for survival in the water. You know, Turner kind of recognizes the diversity of the maritime workforce, because you have black sailors as well as white sailors. And we know from muster books that at Trafalgar, there were sailors not just from the British and Irish Isles in the Royal Navy's fleet, but also from Africa and the Caribbean and Italy and Malta and the Mediterranean. You know, a real kind of international crew. And that's reflected in what Turner shows us. And then you get a sense of the horrors that these individuals are facing too. I think the most chilling detail, and the one that really stands out in my mind, is a single hand reaching up from the water. You can't see anything else of the sailor it belongs to. He's completely submerged. It's just this one hand. And it makes Turner's painting not just a celebration of triumph and glory, but also a reminder of the cost of victory and the sort of sacrifices that it takes to make that, from everyone, from the commander down to the ordinary sailors.
And so many people seem to have had problems with it, including Thomas Hardy, who was the captain on the victory, right beside Nelson, who didn't like some of the elements on it. Others didn't like the fact that it showed the high price that was paid in terms of lives lost. And there was a whole range of different criticisms levelled at Turner and at the painting.
Yeah, so Turner's painting is made, we should say, for King George IV, and it's unveiled in St. James's Palace. So it's a really prestigious commission, and that means it does get a lot of attention from very senior courtiers and senior naval officials too, who they come and they view it, and they are quite critical because they focus on the very specific details. You know, the rigging isn't right there, or actually that mast didn't fall, or that ship didn't sink at this point, and, you know, sort of the timeline is wrong. But, you know, sort of, in some ways, I think they're sort of ignoring what Turner was trying to do, sort of missing the point of the painting. He is combining different moments from the action. He is using artistic license because he is trying to sum up, I suppose, more the feeling of the battle than the fact, a sense of the chaos, the sacrifice, the drama. And so there is a sense that kind of, with its initial audience, James's Palace, sort of misses the mark. But it's a really interesting painting because it has a kind of second life. After just 5 years in the Royal Collection, it's transferred to Greenwich Hospital, kind of precursor to our museum here in Greenwich. And it's displayed in the Painted Hall at Greenwich Hospital, which back then was functioning as an art gallery. And Greenwich Hospital is a home for disabled and sort of elderly sailors, where they're provided with sort of care and long-term accommodation. And they act as tour guides in the art gallery in the hospital. And so there's this kind of really interesting dialogue between the foregrounding of Turner's painting, the foregrounding in Turner's painting of the ordinary sailors, and then these ordinary sailors who are sort of being cared for in later life at Greenwich Hospital. There grows this sort of tone of nostalgia around it. You know, people say you can go to Greenwich and you can hear the war stories of the old sailors, and you can see Turner's painting and reflect back on what is increasingly a vision of the maritime warfare of the past. I mean, it's not, you know, sort of it's within a few decades of Trafalgar that steam power comes in. The whole nature of kind of, you know, the British Navy completely shifts technologically. Its role is different too, you know, sort of rather than fighting these big conflicts, you know, Britain is a huge imperial power in the Victorian period, and its Navy is kind of acting as a sort of global policeman, and it's sort of doing gunboat diplomacy and, you know, other kinds of work that aren't fighting big naval battles. And it, Turner's painting becomes this icon for a kind of nostalgia for a kind of an age of sail and a sort of a recognition of the sort of people who fought in that too.
Do you think it is a masterpiece?
I think so. I think it's hard not to be impressed by it in terms of its scale and its ambition. Kind of an outlier within sort of Turner's work. You know, sort of he's perhaps more known for his slightly more almost impressionistic, you know, kind of anticipating kind of sort of later developments in kind of modern art in some of his works. And I think people think of that and don't think of him as a battle painter or a kind of great history painter. But I think that makes this painting all the more interesting because he's doing something that is a little bit different and really showing that he as an artist wants to record the important events of his time, the important events that he has lived through and that have shaped the world that he knows. And that, I think, for me, makes it a masterpiece.
It's interesting the way, and I'm thinking of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, it's interesting in the way sometimes something can be very controversial at the time, it can be very criticised at the time, but then with the passage of time, people grow to admire and like and celebrate it.
I think that's a really good analogy, and I think in the case of Turner's painting, sort of the change of context does that really powerfully, this move from the sort of royal collection where it is only seen by a narrow circle of courtiers into a much more kind of public space at Greenwich. And that's the story that kind of continues today. I mean, it's sort of moved from Greenwich Hospital to our museum, the National Maritime Museum, now part of Royal Museums Greenwich, which was founded in the 1930s, and has been a kind of mainstay of our public displays ever since. And here it's also in, you know, sort of in dialogue with other important historical artifacts from Trafalgar. I mean, perhaps most famously, Nelson's uniform that he was wearing when he was killed and that still has the bullet hole in the shoulder. A really kind of evocative piece of history from the battle. And, you know, that is here at Greenwich. The painting is here at Greenwich. And, you know, so it does kind of create this sort of moment of kind of memorialization, but also a chance to kind of think about the history of Trafalgar and what that means. We're redisplaying Turner's painting in the Queen's House, our flagship art gallery, to sort of continue that sort of public exposure of the painting and allowing people to encounter it anew and find new ways of looking at it and new ways of appreciating it.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Catherine Gazzard for joining me tonight to talk about Turner's The Battle of Trafalgar. Her book is J.M.W. Turner's The Battle of Trafalgar, Commemoration and Controversy. She's the creator of art at the Royal Museums Greenwich. And Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be rejoining our panel after the break as we explore the legacy of the Battle of Trafalgar. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we are talking about the Battle of Trafalgar. And I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Andrew Lambert, Lawton Professor of Naval History at King's College London. He's an expert on the naval and strategic history of the British Empire. And his books include Nelson, Britannia's God of War, Sea Power State, and most recently, No More Napoleons, How Britain Managed Europe from Waterloo to World War I. I'm also rejoined by Dr. Ciarán McDonnell, an independent researcher specialising in 18th century war and society. He's published on Irish soldiers in the armies of France and Britain, as well as the Irish militia, and is currently researching the coastal defences of Ireland during the Napoleonic Wars. And before the break there, we heard from Dr. Catherine Gazzard about Turner's iconic The Battle of Trafalgar. Andrew, could I ask you what might have happened or what potentially would have happened if Nelson had lost the Battle of Trafalgar?
That's a really good question, because when the enemy fleet leaves Cadiz, which is on the south coast of Spain, it's a Franco-Spanish fleet with troops on board, and they are not heading to invade England. They are sailing for Sicily, which is a critical support base for the British fleet and forces in the Mediterranean. At this point, the British have occupied Malta, and Malta is supplied with food and quite often water from Sicily. Napoleon knows this. He's ordered his fleet to land the troops to capture Sicily, which would keep the British out of the eastern Mediterranean. Nelson knows this because he's the commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean fleet. So this is the opportunity he needs. The enemy is coming out to achieve strategic effect by landing troops on Sicily. And by destroying that fleet, he's preventing the invasion. He's securing Britain's command of the Mediterranean. It's often said that the battle prevents an invasion. That isn't the case, because the fleet that is destroyed at Trafalgar wasn't heading to England. It was heading in the other direction, to heading into the Eastern Mediterranean. Napoleon has an army on the north coast of France around Boulogne. He has an invasion fleet in the Scheldt estuary, which is now northern Belgium. But he can't get it to sea because he doesn't have a navy that can face the British in battle. His main naval force is on the Breton Peninsula at Brest. That's the main French naval fleet. And throughout this campaign, those ships never leave harbor because the French are outnumbered and outpowered by a very big British Channel fleet. So there's a battle in the Mediterranean. There is no battle off the north coast of France. The French simply can't get out to escort their invasion shipping. So even if Nelson had lost the Battle of Trafalgar, there was another larger fleet, very well commanded by Sir William Cornwallis, that would have fought any French force trying to conduct an invasion. But the death of Nelson, the scale of the victory, draws all the attention away from that. So we forget the strategic picture. We think about this iconic moment. And victory at Trafalgar is seen as a symbol of why Britain isn't represented. It's not actually why Britain isn't invaded, but it is symbolically the most potent way of discussing this. And by the 20th century, it means that the British think in order to defend their country from an invasion, they have to defeat and destroy the enemy's fleet. They don't. They just have to stop it putting to sea.
Ciarán, let's talk about the legacy in terms of Ireland, and especially the legacy in the short term.
Yes, so all the Martello Towers and defensive works that have begun at the start of the Napoleonic Wars, a lot of them aren't completed by 1805. The construction will stretch on well into the rest of the Napoleonic Wars, and this is what we have to remember, that after Trafalgar, there is another 10 years of warfare on land and sea against Napoleon, and there's a lot of work done to increase the defences of Ireland. Of course, this is after the Act of Union as well, and whereas prior to the Act of Union, the independent Irish Parliament had more focus on an outward-looking trade with the empire, the growing empire, whereas post-Act of Union, a lot more focus becomes a lot more insular. It looks from the Irish to the English side of the Irish Sea, so it's a more inward-looking perspective, and both in terms of trade and in terms of military resources. And this is very important because Ireland is supplying food and other supplies to Britain to support its war effort against Napoleon. So Britain is bankrolling the armies of Europe to fight Napoleon, when at the same time Ireland is providing supplies for the army and the navy. This is incredibly important work, and particularly the stations in Cork, sending troops, providing the stopping point for troops being sent over to the Peninsular War under Wellington, and also just for supplying food and other supplies for the Royal Navy as well, because the Royal Navy was still needed, both, as Andrew has mentioned, to bottle up the French fleets in port under the blockade, blockading other French ports from any trade that they could be trying to make with the outside world, and to take the fight to France, both in somewhere close by, like the Peninsular War, but also overseas, seizing colonies. And from the start of the wars until the end, Britain doubles its amount of colonial possessions, taking colonies that the French or the Dutch would have held from all over the world, and particularly in South Africa and into the East Indies.
And Ciarán, do you find it interesting that it's such an iconic and significant battle in British history and in British folklore and memory, but it doesn't have the same resonance in Ireland at all, or anywhere near the same kind of attention?
Yes, and I think that's firstly because it was seen, the Royal Navy, it stretches back, of course, to the times of Francis Drake and so on, and the Spanish Armada, so it has a very long heritage to draw upon. The British Army, whether in England or its reputation in Ireland, is always seen as the lesser service. The Royal Navy is referred to as the senior service, whereas the army was often seen as the tool of despots. It was associated with the War of the Three Kingdoms and Charles I and so on. So it's it was always seen as a more untrustworthy partner. It all probably because it was it could be used to topple lawful governance, whereas the same couldn't be said about the Navy. I think for Ireland as well, you don't have Irish ships in the same way as you have Irish regiments. So in the army, you could build a strong Irish military tradition around the Connacht Rangers, the Irish Fusiliers, the 87th, Prince of Wales' own. They provided an Irish identity within the British military structure, whereas in the Royal Navy, when you joined the Royal Navy, you could be sent to any ship, whether you were just a rank and file seaman or if you were an officer. As Andrew mentioned, there was plenty of skilled Irish officers, Anglo-Irish officers, but they never coalesced in that same way. You wouldn't have had an Irish ship like the way like you would have had an Irish regiment. So I think that's why the Irish element of the Royal Navy history hasn't been as recognised as, say, the Irish tradition in the army.
Andrew, this is the 220th anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar. And I wonder, when you look at the battle 220 years on, I suppose, how do you view the legacy and how should we consider the legacy today?
I think, you know, what we've been talking about is how this battle is central to the construction of an English-British identity. And those parts of the United Kingdom that are still within it share that identity to a greater or lesser extent. A disproportionate number of officers and men serving in Nelson's Navy came from the south of England, the north of England, Scotland and Wales, less so. Rather like the Irish experience, this was an English institution into which the rest of the United Kingdom was increasingly engaged. I think by Nelson's day, it is a truly British Navy, and it remains so from that point on. The legacy, it explains the British exceptionalism. It's deep in the DNA of how the British view the world. They take a maritime view. They take a global view. We think about the world in ways which are different, I think, to most of our European and wider national allies, friends, and indeed opponents. If you talk to the Russians, they don't have great naval victories to celebrate. They have great naval defeats. So this does matter. And you'll find that it's no accident that the great picture of Trafalgar was painted by Turner, who was the artist who created a British visual culture throughout the Napoleonic era, when it was not possible for the British to travel around Europe and join a European culture. They were excluded. And he was the one who told the British that they needed to look at their own fabulous countryside, all the parts of the then United Kingdom. And he then sums that up and delivers us Trafalgar as the defining moment in the history of the British and their connection with the world. So his work, and then later with the famous picture, The Fighting Temeraire, when he's talking about the transition from sailing ships to steamships, he's using Trafalgar as a metaphor. He says, look, here is this heroic sailing ship from Trafalgar, but it's being taken into the future by this new technology. And of course, the Royal Navy will transition from wooden sailing ships to iron and steel steamships, and it will continue to be an enormously successful, highly aggressive, and very effective war-winning instrument right down to the end of the Second World War. So Nelson's legacy is a long one. The world that we live in is largely shaped by that maritime imperative which the British are engaged in. It explains, for example, why cricket is played at a very enthusiastic and expert level on the Indian subcontinent, and indeed in Australia. So world sport is spread by naval domination. The British Empire is a cultural phenomenon, and its resonance is still felt right around the world.
And there was an incredible bicentenary celebration and commemoration of the battle, and Queen Elizabeth II was there to review the ships, and Prince Charles was there, and other members of the royal family. I think there was a Spitfire, and there was modern or more recent 20th century technology as well. And then there was also, I think, some controversy because there was a kind of a mock battle, but there was a red team against the blue team. And some people criticized that for kind of trying to avoid offending the French or trying to bring any modern day, present day countries into it. So how did you feel it was commemorated and how it should be commemorated?
Great honour to have been at the review on one of the Royal Navy warships. It was a fabulous occasion because this had been how Britain celebrated victory. At the end of the Napoleonic Wars, there was a great fleet review at Spithead, exactly where this fleet review was held, to make the point that Britain was on the winning side because of its naval domination. And that was an event where we invited a lot of countries from around the world. Even the Russians were there back in the days when Russia was not an outcast as it is today. A lot of navies came because Nelson is the defining naval commander, and the Royal Navy has historically been the defining naval force. So it was an homage, an international homage to both Nelson and the Navy that he led. The red and blue team, well, you know, they fought a battle with some fireworks after dark. It was charming, but not particularly useful. On the day, I was in the church at Burnham Thorpe where Nelson's father was in charge, and I spoke about Nelson in a church that he knew very well, and I was literally standing on top of the grave markers of Nelson's parents. It was a really special occasion because this immense, internationally famed, war-winning admiral, he's also a human being, and he comes from a very small village, hardly 20 miles from where I was born, so I do feel great affinity with him in that sense. So there's within this story, there is a very significant human character. And he is somebody who is driven to excel in his chosen profession by his faith, his politics, his identity, and his camaraderie with the people that he leads. You know, he's among the greatest leaders in history because he understands the people that he is leading, he understands the task that he has, and he has both the mental agility and the self-confidence to make big decisions that have truly world-changing consequences. So I think he will live forever as one of the great commanders, the greatest of all naval commanders, and the exemplary figure who defines how we think about Englishness. And of course, he's buried under the crossing of St. Paul's Cathedral in the City of London, at the very epicenter of a pantheon of British heroism, as an example to generations yet unborn, as they used to say. So he has a critical role in how we think about the nation, the past, the present, and the future.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight, reflecting on the past, present and future by looking at the Battle of Trafalgar on this, the 220th anniversary. My thanks to Professor Andrew Lambert, Lawton Professor of Naval History at King's College London, Dr. Ciarán McDonnell, an independent researcher specialising in 18th century war and society. And earlier we heard from Dr. Catherine Gazzard, the cultural historian and curator of art at the Royal Museum's Greenwich and the author of Turner's The Battle of Trafalgar. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.